National Public Radio. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Renee Montaigne, with All Things Considered.
This announcement in Chicago, where Mayor Harold Washington suffered a heart attack.
Unfortunately, the mayor sustained irreversible brain damage. We could not get any signs of neurologic recovery nor spontaneous cardiac activity, and he was pronounced dead at 1:36 this afternoon.
Harold Washington was Chicago's first black mayor. He won election to a second term last spring.
Also, the NATO allies call the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement an historic breakthrough.
But some members of the president's party oppose it.
Their objections
and tactics.
First, this news.
It's All Things Considered. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The city of Chicago is in mourning this evening following the sudden death today of Mayor Harold Washington. Mr. Washington, who became the city's first black mayor in 1983, suffered cardiac arrest today in his office while meeting with aides. He was rushed to the hospital, but he died 2.5 hours later, never regaining consciousness. Marge Halperin reports.
I'm Al Tonola, the mayor's press secretary, and it's my sad responsibility to let you know that Mayor Washington was pronounced dead this afternoon at 1:36.
It was to be a day like so many others for Harold Washington. He attended a news conference at 10 o'clock this morning discussing housing on the city's south side. He returned to his City Hall office for a briefing on the rest of the day's schedule, talking with his press secretary, Alton Miller.
He worked with the secretary, Dolores Woods, who was in and out of the office several times, looking forward to a busy day. He suddenly, In general chit-chat about this morning's press, he slumped to one side. I thought he was trying to pick something up off the floor, like a pen that he might have dropped. And I quickly realized that it was more serious than that, called the mayor's security detail. And the rest from there is documented, is on paper, and there's no question about the quality of the response time or the quality of the health care.
Washington, who was 65 years old, had been complaining for the past few days of some sort of chest cold or virus, and he'd cut back his work schedule to recuperate. He was once a heavy smoker, but quit about a year ago, and his weight jumped sharply as soon as he did so. Still, Washington was not one to be preoccupied with his own mortality, according to his chief of staff, Ernest Bearfield.
The mayor always had a great expectation to be mayor for 20 years, and I think that is something that he has not spent a lot of time thinking about.
Because of Washington's often stated plans to be mayor of Chicago for 20 years, he leaves no hand-picked successor. The city's vice mayor, city council member David Orr, takes over immediately as interim mayor until the full council can meet to choose someone from among its ranks to serve out the rest of Washington's term. Orr was with the mayor's friends and aides as the announcement was made.
This city has lost a very good friend and a great mayor, and in the great mayor's memory, we should all do all we can to pull together, and we will make sure that things happen successfully for the city.
Harold Washington was the city's first black mayor. He was a reluctant candidate in 1983 who was drafted by a growing black political faction. First seen as a no-chance candidate, Washington beat incumbent Jane Byrne in the Democratic primary. In this overwhelmingly Democratic city, that assured him of winning the general election. Washington was reelected to another 4-year term in April of this year. To win his second term, he beat his political arch-rival Edward Oleak, a city council member who led what remained of Chicago's once powerful Democratic machine. During Washington's first years in office, Verdoliak had control of a majority of city council votes and continually stalled and stopped the mayor's programs. Once Washington was reelected, the mayor took control of the city council and pushed ahead with his promised reign of reform. He bragged of stamping out patronage hiring in Chicago and ushered in a new city ethics law for public officials and a tenants' rights bill, as well as other programs he had trumpeted on the campaign trail. As they mourn the death of their mayor, Chicagoans are reminded of the day they lost longtime Mayor Richard Daley. Daley also died of a heart attack during the holiday season, stricken as he left his doctor's office December 20th, 1976. No funeral plans have been set yet for Mayor Harold Washington. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
Thousands of stunned residents have gathered outside of Chicago's City Hall, where Alderman Danny Davis has his office.
People are, in fact, gathering not only outside here, but also
Harold Washington was the first black mayor of the city of Chicago. What did he mean to that city, to your city?
His election gave a signal, I think, to all of the people that Chicago was indeed coming of age, that it did, in fact, have the potential of being one city with one major spirit and with one major direction, and gave hope to disadvantaged, underprivileged, disenfranchised people all over the world that government could, in fact, work for them. And I think that that really becomes the true legacy of the impact of a Harold Washington.
Mayor Washington was elected, of course, to his first term by a massive turnout of black voters. And when he first was elected, one of the things he said was that the Democratic Party had been, I'm quoting here, the Democratic Party has been returned to the people. But his first term was quite tumultuous. He didn't, as you say, have enemies.
Well, I think it took a while. Kind of reforms that Harold Washington brought to government were not necessarily the kind of reforms that all people wanted to see. His reform movement opened up government. There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it. His reform movement helped to equalize the distribution of services and of resources to all people and to all parts of the city.
Alderman Davis, Harold Washington was an amateur boxer in high school and in college. Did you see anything in any of that reflected, that part of his personality reflected in his relations with white politicians?
Oh, I think unequivocally and without a doubt, Mayor Washington was tough and tenacious. Not only was he a boxer, but he was also a runner. So he was quite an athlete. He had tremendous strength as an individual, a tremendous amount of will, patience that was unbelievable.
There are those in some quarters around the country who are now predicting already that there will be a major political brawl over who will succeed Mayor Washington. Do you see that happening?
I don't think so. I think the city council is one of the most astute bodies that you would find anywhere in the country. I think we're going to see a rather orderly transition. The city of Chicago is in good hands.
Danny Davis is an alderman who represents Chicago's 29th Ward on the West Side. Davis has been a friend and political associate of Mayor Harold Washington for 20 years.
The NATO alliance has hailed the new Soviet-American Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement as an historic breakthrough and a vindication of alliance strategy. That was the message U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz said that he received in Brussels today after briefing alliance foreign ministers. Shultz was on his way home to Washington from Geneva, where yesterday he announced that an agreement had been reached on a new treaty eliminating shorter and medium-range nuclear missiles from Europe. NPR's Bill Buesenberg in London has more on the NATO response.
Governments in West Germany, Great Britain, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands strongly welcomed the new treaty today. As a spokesman for the Belgian government put it, "We're very pleased that the cohesion and firmness which the Atlantic Alliance displayed on this matter has finally paid off." After his NATO briefing, a tired Secretary Shultz made a similar point, saying the alliance was delighted with the new treaty.
"This isn't a U.S. treaty. This is their treaty. This is an alliance treaty. In a sense, the whole process came out of an alliance decision. All of the alliances involved, particularly the basin countries, are involved. So this is something we have done together. And I think there is a absolutely uniform and full sense of support. And anyone who says that Europe doesn't like this treaty just doesn't have a clue about European attitudes."
The reference to an alliance treaty stems from the fact it came about because of a key NATO decision taken in 1979. That was after the Soviet Union had just begun installing medium-range missiles in Eastern Europe. Those Soviet missiles were aimed at Western Europe. The NATO response to the Soviets was to say either remove your SS-20 missiles or the West will install medium-range missiles of its own, missiles aimed at the East. The Soviets didn't budge, so in 1981, NATO began implementing its so-called dual-track strategy, that is, deploying American cruise and Pershing II missiles, while at the same time offering to negotiate with the Soviets to remove all medium-range missiles. The deployment of new American missiles in Western Europe set off a wave of forceful anti-nuclear protests, particularly in the so-called basing countries where the missiles were to be located, West Germany, Britain, Belgium, Italy, and the Netherlands. But NATO governments stuck to their strategy, despite some internal misgivings, and officials believe that strategy has now been vindicated. Now that the Soviets have agreed to remove all shorter and medium-range nuclear missiles, nearly 2,000 warheads altogether in East and West, in a sense, the situation will revert to the way it was before 1979, when the Soviets had not yet deployed their weapons. Secretary Shultz said today that the United States will have spent $7 to $9 billion to implement NATO's deployment and negotiation strategy. Today, British Foreign Secretary Sir Geoffrey Howe backed up Shultz, saying all 16 NATO countries were behind the new treaty. Howe said charges by some American conservatives that the Allies were being steamrollered into accepting the treaty were simply not true.
I think that's a very curious insight. When both sides have been laboring long and hard for 7 years to achieve this particular agreement, to say they've been steamrollered into it by some God-given reluctance seems to me to be profoundly fanciful. NATO, in communique after communique, has said, we want a deal on INF weapons. We've worked for it for 7 years. The European countries have had the courage together to deploy cruise and Pershing missiles as all part of the process. We've done that to get this deal. We've got it. There should be no reservations about it.
The reservations or misgivings that do exist in Western Europe have to do primarily with concerns about the superiority of Soviet conventional forces, as well as fears that in the future, the United States might move to withdraw more than its medium-range missiles from Western Europe. For example, the U.S. might withdraw its ground forces or its entire nuclear umbrella. NATO's Secretary General, Lord Carrington, said today that on the whole, the alliance believes the new treaty is an unqualified success. Carrington explained the concerns in Europe in these terms.
I don't think the misgivings are about this agreement. I think that if there are any misgivings, they're about those who say we should go faster in the next stage, the denuclearization of Europe at a moment when there is such a very considerable conventional imbalance between the Warsaw Pact and NATO is something which none of us would contemplate. So I don't think it's so much misgivings as a realization that we have to be careful in the future not to upset what has been a stable situation so far.
It was also announced today that NATO will stop deploying any new medium-range missiles in Western Europe as soon as the treaty is signed in Washington. In other words, even before it's ratified or rejected by the U.S. Senate. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
Even though the NATO allies are generally in favor of it, the treaty does have many detractors here among conservatives. James Hackett of the Heritage Foundation is former acting director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. He says conservatives oppose the treaty for the following reasons.
One is the fact that the Soviets have been violating other agreements, and it makes no sense to sign a new one until they get into full compliance with existing agreements. So that should be the first part or first priority of any new agreement, is compliance with existing agreements. The second point is the fact that this agreement will draw down or reduce the nuclear weapons in Europe that defend NATO. And this has been a long-term goal of the Soviet Union. The Germans and the Soviets have already indicated that they're both willing to reduce further and go into the tactical or short-range nuclear weapons. Now, these are the weapons that defend NATO against the huge Soviet conventional forces, the large tank army that threatens Western Europe. So this reduction will possibly lead to first the denuclearization and then the neutralization of Central Europe and possibly the dissolution of NATO.
Now, on your first point about violations of prior agreements, the verification terms of this one are supposed to be very good.
Yes, the president keeps saying that the verification is going to be the best that we have ever had, and I'm sure that's true. The problem is we're talking about banning weapons that we've never banned before. These are small, mobile weapons that we simply don't know how many the Soviets have, where they are, where they're hidden. We don't know where they are from one day to the next, so there's no really effective way of verifying that the Soviets are complying with this agreement, even with the strictest verification we've ever had.
Let me ask you, this is an agreement which you, as a supporter of President Reagan, might claim great credit for and point out that your political opponents, Democrats, liberals, would have accepted Soviet SS-20s and said, don't deploy the cruise missiles or the Pershing 2s. President hung in there, refused to yield, deployed the weapons, the beginnings of the deployments, and then got his point, won the day, got the Soviets to dismantle.
Well, we're not satisfied that the drawdown of 3% of Soviet nuclear forces is a sufficient action if the result is the threat to NATO by the Soviet conventional forces, and if it leads to a general arms control attitude of euphoria, which means lower defense budgets and possibly great reluctance to do the other things that are needed to build up NATO and to defend the West.
You're concerned that this could be the gateway to a new era of detente.
That's absolutely right. We saw during the 1970s that Soviet power increased globally as American power decreased, and we don't want to see that happen again.
This treaty is going to require ratification by the Senate, two-thirds vote. Do you think that conservative opponents of it will make a fight of it?
Well, they certainly will. The treaty has not yet been seen. We don't know exactly what's in it, but there is enough known about it to raise great concerns and apprehensions, and certainly there will be a range of possible amendments, provisions, addenda that will be proposed, such as the deployment of anti-tactical ballistic missiles to Western Europe to protect against Soviet cheating, to provide insurance against that contingency. And there will be other provisions.
So-called killer amendments, if attacked.
Some of them could be killer amendments. Others might improve the agreement and make it acceptable. And if we were to deploy adequate defenses to Europe, then perhaps the verification would not matter.
James Hackett, former acting director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, early in the Reagan administration.
On Capitol Hill, the battle over ratification of the Intermediate-Range Missile Treaty has already begun, with some Republicans in the Senate warning the White House that they will have trouble voting for the pact unless some changes are made. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
President Reagan's problems with the treaty come from members of his own party. Democrats, for the most part, have hailed the agreement as a significant step in arms control, and their chief concern stems only from the fact that the pact has probably robbed them of a potent political issue for the 1988 presidential campaign. Presidential politics will complicate the ratification debate as the Republican leader of the Senate, Robert Dole, decides what his best strategy should be. Dole has spent a considerable amount of time wooing the conservative wing of his party in his bid for the Republican presidential nomination, but as Senate leader, he's often forced into compromises which alienate the right. With other presidential candidates denouncing the treaty with the Soviets, Dole might find it difficult to lead the fight for its ratification among his party members in the Senate. Others in the Senate keep emphasizing their role, which is often a touchy problem when it comes to treaty ratification. It takes two-thirds of the Senate to approve a treaty, and sometimes, in order to get the votes, an administration is forced to accept amendments, or reservations in the language, which could have the effect of unraveling the arrangement. Some Senate Republicans have talked, for instance, about linking acceptance of this pact to the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan. Though administration spokesmen have said they plan to use Soviet leader Gorbachev's visit to help in the ratification process, conservatives on Capitol Hill have also been extremely critical of any attempts to have the General Secretary address a joint session of Congress. A speedy process would probably enhance prospects for ratification, but the senior Republican on the Armed Services Committee, Virginia's John Warner, said today he approached this treaty in a positive fashion, but it's important that the Senate not rush to judgment, that the relevant committees should hold extensive hearings followed by a full floor debate. That means the vote could be delayed until well into next year, when presidential politics will dominate everything. I'm Cokie Roberts in Washington.
Mm-hmm. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bob Edwards. Tomorrow on NPR's Morning Edition, we'll visit the home of Morning Edition commentator and gourmet cook, Rod McLeish, to discuss the importance of holiday feasts and to learn how to make curried parsnips. Also, we'll find out how one immigrant family celebrates Thanksgiving in their new country. That and more tomorrow on NPR's Morning Edition. ¶¶